Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle, Washington. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, author and journalist David Brooks says he gets paid to be a narcissistic blowhard, and that he has to work harder than most people to avoid a life of smug superficiality. As far as blowhards go, he seems fairly humble. He told NPR, quote, "The turning point in a life toward maturity is looking inside yourself and saying, what's the weakness that I have that leads to behavior that I'm not proud of?" Brooks' most recent book is The Road to Character. In it, he challenges himself and his readers to balance so-called resume virtues, wealth, fame, and status, against eulogy virtues, kindness, honesty, and faithfulness. He argues that our big me culture should rethink priorities in order to build richer inner lives. To aid in this pursuit, he looks to the lives of historical figures who struggled to build their character. In this talk, he reflects on examples from President Dwight Eisenhower, Samuel Johnson, Francis Perkins, and George Eliot. David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times and commentator for PBS, NPR, and NBC. He teaches at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. His other books include The Social Animal, Bobos in Paradise, and On Paradise Drive. David Brooks spoke at Town Hall Seattle on April 29, 2015. His talk was presented by the Elliott Bay Book Company. Thanks to Kevin Mitchum for our recording.
Pleasure to be back in this room. I've had very good memories of this room. I actually could have grown up here. My father grew up here in Seattle. And unfortunately, his mother, my grandmother, took him away at a young age to New York. She moved to Greenwich Village and started an art gallery. Or else I would have been raised here and been a lot happier. So be careful of what you do. You never know. Generations can suffer. And so I did grow up in Greenwich Village to parents who were somewhat left-wing. In 1965, they took me to a bee-in where hippies would go just to be. It was in Central Park, and they lit a garbage can on fire and threw their wallets into it to demonstrate how little they cared about money and material things. And I was five, and I saw a $5 bill on fire there, so I broke from the crowd, reached into the fire, grabbed the money, and ran away. That was my first step over to the right. That's just one of the many turns that life offers that surprises us. I went to a school called Grace Church School in Lower Manhattan. If you know the Strand Bookstore, it's right across the street. I was part of the all-Jewish boys davening band choir at Grace. We would sing the hymns, but to square it with our religion, we wouldn't sing the word Jesus, so the volume would drop down. And that was another weird turn. I knew at a very early age I wanted to become a writer at age seven. I read a book called Paddington the Bear, and I thought, I'm going to do that. That sounds good to me. And I remember in high school I wanted to date a woman named Bernice. She didn't want to date me. She wanted to date some other guy. And I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy. And so the identity was formed. The social life didn't really follow. I then went off to the University of Chicago, where fun goes to die. And actually, that's a little obsolete. The accurate saying about Chicago is it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. And so I went there. I learned some great books, and that fed into this book as well. And then I went to work for the New York Times as a conservative writer on the op-ed page, a job I likened to being chief rabbi at Mecca. Not always a lot of company there. And I do a show on Friday nights called the NewsHour, PBS NewsHour, with a guy named Mark Shields, who is a sweet and wonderful man. We call our segment Shields and Brooks for seniority reasons, but Brooks Shields would work better. And I tell Mark that Mark's a little older than me. He's been doing it for a little while. The segment is called Shields and Brooks. Before that, it was Shields and Gigot. And before that, it was Shields and Gergen. And then before that, it was Shields and Coolidge, I think. And then I think it was Shields and Epictetus at the very beginning. I don't know, something like that. And so that's these things all are unexpected bits of life. And sometimes those unexpected bits have lasting impact. And I was driving home from doing the show with Mark one Friday night about 10 years ago almost now. And I was driving to my home, which was then in Bethesda, Maryland. And it was the summertime, so it was still light out. I got home at about 7:20. And I pulled into the driveway, which wrapped around the side of our house. And I could see into the backyard. And my kids, who were then 12, 9, and 4, were out in the backyard playing with a ball they'd gotten at the grocery store, one of those big rubber balls. And they were kicking it up in the air. And it was curving and arcing and landing on the other side of the yard. And they were running over to it and chasing it and seeing who could grab it first and then tumbling and all on top of each other and laughing and having a great time with each other. And it was a perfect weather. The evening sun was coming through the trees. The grass was green. And I just pull into the driveway and I see this tableau. And I was startled by it. It's what, you know, any father would love to see. And it was one of those moments sat there in the car staring out at them running across the yard through the windshield. And it's one of those moments when life and time are suspended, when reality sort of spills outside its boundaries and you get a sense of feeling overwhelmed by gratitude. So what did I do to deserve this kind of happiness? And you experience at those moments a happiness that is better than anything you ever get at work. And you get it exposes your depths. It opens you up a little and exposes vulnerabilities inside. And then it arouses a strange stirring that you want to be worthy of this kind of happiness. And I get that in moments of transcendence like that, of happiness. I get it sometimes when I'm around people. You've probably met these people who just generate an inner light. I was fortunate enough over the summer to be seated at a Washington luncheon next to the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama is a guy who just generates light. And so I'm sitting next to him, and he's the sort of person who laughs at odd moments. He just starts laughing. And so he starts laughing. You want to be polite, so you laugh too, and you laugh along with him. And nothing is being said. He's just laughing. And you want to insert a joke just to sort of justify the laughter somehow. So I was sort of awkward, and finally he had this little Dalai Lama bag, a canvas bag he carries around with him. And so I didn't know what to say. I said, "You got any candy in there?" And so he starts pulling out the stuff in the bag, and basically it's everything you get in the first class cabin of an international flight. So it's like the little eye patch, the earplugs, the little razor, toothbrush. And then he pulls out a Toblerone bar, so he did have a big Toblerone bar. And so he had that inner light. He's a global celebrity. I've met other people who've had that inner light, some of whom are not famous. I was up in Frederick, Maryland, which is just northwest of D.C., and I happened to be in a room with about 30 women, probably age 50 to 80, who teach immigrants how to read. And it can take up to 7 years to teach them English and then how to read. And I walk in there with these women, and you feel immediately their sweetness and their patience. They're sort of glowing with just happiness to be with each other. They had sort of a musical laughter, and they seemed settled and rooted, and they made me feel so valuable when I walked in amongst them. And they weren't thinking about what wonderful work they do. They weren't thinking about themselves at all. And when I'm around people like that or people like the Dalai Lama, I think I've had way more career success than I ever thought I would. But I don't have that inner light that they have. I don't have that. And you only go around once in life, and you might as well try to get that. And so I've been was thinking about, what do they have? What is that thing that they have? And so it came to my mind that there are two sets of virtues, which you might call the eulogy virtues and the resume virtues. And the resume virtues are the things you bring to the marketplace, whether it makes you a good teacher or accountant or whatever it is. The eulogy virtues are the things they say about you after you're dead. Are you brave, courageous, honest, honorable, capable of great love, capable of having really strong relationships? And we all know the eulogy virtues are more important. But we live in a culture, a society, an educational system that is a lot clearer and spends a lot more time on the resume virtues than on the eulogy ones. And a book that helped me think about this was written in 1965 by a guy named Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, and it's called Lonely Man of Faith. And Soloveitchik says that we have two sides of our nature. Each of us has two sides of our nature, which he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the resume side, the career-oriented, ambitious side of our nature. Adam 1 wants to build things, create, produce, discover things. Adam 2 is the internal Adam. Adam 2 wants to embody certain moral qualities, wants to have a strong inner character, a solid sense of right and wrong, not only to do good, but to be good inside. And so while Adam 1 wants to conquer the world, Adam 2 wants to obey a calling and serve the world. Adam 1 asks how things work. Adam 2 asks why things exist and what ultimately we're here for. Adam 1 wants to venture forth. Adam 2 wants to return home to the warmth of a family meal or friends at a bar. And Soloveitchik argues that these two sides of our nature are sometimes in conflict. Sometimes they go together, but sometimes they're in conflict. I have a friend who hires a lot of people, and at the job interviews, he asks this question: name a time you told the truth and it hurt you. And he's trying to get a sense, is this person willing to put Adam 2 above Adam 1 sometimes? And I'd say they're in conflict sometimes because they operate by different logics. Adam 1, the external Adam, lives by an economic logic, which is straightforward. Input leads to output, effort leads to reward, practice makes perfect. Adam 2 lives by a moral logic, which is inverse and paradoxical. To build your inside, you have to give to receive. You have to surrender to something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success can lead to the greatest failure, which is pride. Failure can lead to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. And so, as I say, we live in a culture that prioritizes Adam 1. There's a lot clearer about it. We live in a competitive culture where it's hard to get ahead. You just got to spend a lot of time on that stuff. We live with fast and shallow communications that makes it hard to hear the still, soft voices from the deep. We live in a culture, what I call the culture of the big me, that celebrates the self, that says, you are wonderful inside, you're wonderful. You have a little golden figure of goodness inside. The commencement cliches speak to that golden figure. Follow your passion, be true to yourself, listen to your inner voice, trust yourself. We've told several generations, including my own, how great they are, and they believed us. In 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors, are you a very important person? And in 1950, 12% said yes. Gallup asked again in 2005, and it wasn't 12% who thought they were very important, it was 80%. Psychologists have a thing called the narcissism test, where they say, I'm going to read you a bunch of statements, does this apply to you? And they're statements like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so extraordinary. Somebody should write a biography about me. I like to look at my body. The median narcissism score has gone up 30% in the last 20 years. Along with this has gone an increased interest in fame. Fame used to be a reasonably undesirable thing. UCLA does these surveys of college freshmen. What would you like out of life? And for many decades, the number one answer was, I'd like to have a meaningful philosophy of life. Now that's the bottom answer. The number one answer is financial security, and the number two or three answer is usually fame. It's shot upward. And so somebody did a study of junior high school girls. Would you rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant, a celebrity's personal assistant, or president of Harvard? And of course, by 3-1, they'd rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. Though to be fair, I asked the president of Harvard, and she would rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. College students are asked, would you rather have a life that involves a lot of fame or a life that involves a lot of sex? And by 2-1, they'd prefer the life of fame. And I go to colleges and I tell them, I'm on TV twice a week, I work for a prominent newspaper, I'm kind of famous, go with the sex, it's better. And so this is a rise of self. And with that rise of self and an emphasis on Adam 1, has gone moral inarticulateness. It's not that people are bad today. I don't think we're in decadence or decline. We're just not as clear about the inner life as we used to be. Christian Smith is a sociologist who goes around asking people about their... one of the questions he asks is, what was the last moral dilemma you faced? And 70% cannot name a moral dilemma. They'll say, well, you know, I pulled into a parking space. I didn't have enough quarters. They'll say, that's sort of a problem. It's not really a moral dilemma. And they just don't have the vocabulary to describe what happens when two values clash. Google Engrams measures the words we use in our newspapers, magazines, and books. Economic word usage is shooting up over the last 50 years. Moral words are used less and less frequently. So the word bravery is down 66%, gratitude is down 49%, humbleness is down 52%, kindness is down 56%. We just don't talk about that stuff as much. What the Victorians were to sex, we are to morality. And I find, and I found in my own life, if you trend too much on Adam 1 and ignore the inner life, you turn into sort of a shrewd animal. You turn too clever, you treat life as a game, you lose the ability to speak in a sophisticated moral language, you live with an unconscious boredom because you're not really attached to high ideals. You slip into a self-satisfied moral mediocrity. You grade yourself on a forgiving curve. You sort of approve yourself. You think, I'm fine. I'm not hurting anybody. People seem to like me. But eventually, you turn a core piece of yourself into something less impressive than you would have liked. There's a gap that opens up between your desired self and your actual self. You're not worthy of the resume you would want or of the eulogy you would want. And you don't have that inner incandescence. And so I wrote this book to figure out, not if I could do it, but see how that was done. How moral lives, how moral education happens, how people get the inner light, how they get better. And I didn't believe in a book of philosophy would do it. I think we learn from people. We learn from each other. We learn from exemplars. And so we all have people in our own lives that serves as models. But there are people who are now dead who have given us the gift of their lives. And I wanted to learn from them. I got an email from a guy named Dave Jolly, who's a veterinarian in Oregon. And it was about how hard it is to teach morality. And Jolly wrote to him, I've never met him, but he's a very wise man. He wrote to me in this email, what a wise person teaches is the smallest part of what they give. The totality of their life, the way they go about it in the smallest detail, is what gets transmitted. Never forget that. The message is the person. Perfected over lifetimes of effort that was set in motion by yet another wise person, hidden from the recipient in the dim mists of time. Life is much bigger than we think, cause and effect intertwined in a vast moral structure that keeps pushing us to do better, become better, even when we dwell in the most painful and confused darkness. And so I like those sentences. The message is the person. What a wise person says is the least of that which he gives. It's the totality of behavior. And so I wanted to learn from people about the totality of their behavior and the way they just conducted themselves in the small and the large aspects of life. And what were the experiences that lead to character building and lead to depth? One of the people I looked at was Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower, when he was 9, he wanted to go out trick-or-treating. His mom wouldn't let him because she said he was too young. Eisenhower punched the tree in his front yard, and he punched it so viciously he rubbed all the skin off his fingers. His mom, this amazing woman named Ida, sent him up to his room, bound his wounds, and recited a verse to him. He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh the city. And 6 years later, when Eisenhower was writing his memoirs, he said that was the most important conversation of his life because it taught him that he had a weakness in himself, his temper, his passion, and that he had to beat it. And so the first lesson his mom, Ida, told him was the lesson of humility. Humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. Humility is accurate self-awareness from a distance. It's the ability to step far outside yourself and see yourself from a distance, see your strength, and mostly see your weakness. It's a quality of self-awareness. The second thing she was teaching him is that you have to confront your weakness, that success is built by being better than other people at a job, but character is built by confronting your own weakness and being better than you used to be. It's in the confrontation with self that character is the byproduct. So Eisenhower confronted his weakness. He was a very angry young man, got in fights, lots of demerits when he was at West Point, but he learned how to defeat that. Even in World War II and as president, he was lying awake, insomnia, anxiety attacks, drinking, throat infections, blood pressure spiking. But he knew he could not lead with that persona. He needed to project cheerful confidence. And so he constructed a temperament on top of that. And some of the things he did were kind of shallow. He would take the names of the people he was hating, write them down over and over on pieces of paper, and rip them up and throw them into the garbage can. And he constructed a temperament which was very sweet out of a nature which was not. Thomas Merton once wrote that souls are like athletes. They need opponents worthy of them if they are to be tried and extended to the full use of their powers. And in his confrontation with themselves, he learned to extend himself to the full use of his internal powers. The second person is Samuel Johnson. Johnson was born in 1709 in England. He barely survived the ordeal of his birth. He was handed over to a wet nurse whose milk infected him with tuberculosis, rendering him blind in one eye, deaf in one ear. He developed smallpox that left him scarred. They performed surgery on his jaw, which left a gouge in his face. They opened his arm to bleed him, and they left the wound open for 6 years. He soon developed what we now think was Tourette's syndrome and OCD. It was very hard to eat with him because he was spewing food out. He was just large, ogre-like, and unattractive. He went to Oxford, dropped out in a year, tried to become a teacher, and failed. By 30, he had led a life that, as he said, was radically wretched. And so he suffered. Now, I'm not a big fan of suffering voluntarily, but moments of suffering happen in all of our lives. And it can be turned into something productive. And that's what Johnson did. Paul Tillich said, the theologian, said that what suffering does is it takes you below the everydayness of life and reminds you you're not the person you thought you were. Suffering carves into the basement of what you thought was your soul and reveals a cavity below, and it carves through the basement of that and reveals a cavity below. And so for Johnson, that moment of suffering was, those moments of suffering were moments of deep self-revelation, self-honesty. But suffering also lifts people up, or can lift people up, if the suffering can be tied to a larger narrative, a narrative of redemption. And he wanted to take his self-knowledge and become empathetic, in the way Franklin Roosevelt became much more empathetic after suffering from polio. Johnson developed an amazing empathy, and he wanted to, and he developed an amazing curiosity. He could not control his own body. He was twitching about. He could not control his own mind. He wanted to tie himself down into the realism of the truth. And so he developed this voracious hunger for knowledge as a way to cure his suffering, his inability to control himself, as a willingness to get stable. And so he developed this rage for knowledge. He walks to London. He starts writing and reading and investigating. His curiosity was sort of reckless sometimes. He was told that a certain river in Oxford, people were drowning in a certain patch of the river, so he jumped in to see what it would have felt like. He was told that if you put two musket balls in a pistol and shot it, the gun would explode. So he put 7 balls in the pistol and shot it against the wall. He took each of the things he suffered from and he wrote essays about them. Sloth, envy, guilt, boredom, sorrow. He took everything he was afraid of and he just wrote about it, probing into the things that scared him most. And so by middle age, he developed a settled philosophy of life. One biographer wrote, "The iron had entered his soul, and he approached questions of human conduct in the light of a terrible experience, which enabled him to penetrate into human motives with sureness and understanding." So by middle age, he's getting stable. He's capable, through his life, of amazing acts of industry driven by this rage to understand. and to order things. It took the French Academy 40 scholars and 50 years to do the first French dictionary. Johnson wrote the first English dictionary with 6 clerks and only 8 years. He started giving away his writing. He had a friend who got a job lecturing law at Oxford. Unfortunately, his friend knew no law. And so Johnson said, "I'll write you the letter, the lectures, don't worry, you just read them." And so he wrote 60 lectures stretching over 1,600 pages of text for free. Between 68 and age 68 and 72, he wrote a book called Lives of the Poets, 52 biographies covering 378,000 words between 68 and 72. He was a member of the most exclusive men's club maybe in English history, with Edmund Burke and Adam Smith and Joshua Reynolds and many other prominent people. And yet, at home, he collected stray people who had nowhere else to go. He had between 10 and 13 people living with him, they were former prostitutes, former slave, a doctor who had no money, various people with no money who had nowhere to go. And he just extended the warmth of his home to them. When he died, people understood that a great, great man had died. One of his colleagues wrote, "He has made a chasm which not only nothing can fill up, but which nothing has a tendency to fill up. Johnson is dead. Let us go with the next best. There's nobody. No man can be said to put you in the mind of Johnson." And so while Eisenhower gives us the example of self-defeat, self-confrontation, Johnson gives us an example of how to use suffering, and then how important it is to use intellectual activity as a moral cause, as an act of creating integrity. The third person I'll mention is Frances Perkins. She was the first woman to be in a U.S. cabinet. She was Secretary of Labor under Franklin Roosevelt. She was a young woman from Maine. She went to Mount Holyoke College. The rules at Mount Holyoke were somewhat different than most college rules are today. I'm going to read you some of the rules from the class of 1902. Freshmen should keep a respectful silence in the presence of sophomores. Freshmen meeting a sophomore on campus shall bow respectfully. No freshman shall wear a long skirt or hair high on head before the mid-year examinations. And yet, Holyoke was intensely interested in forming the character of the students in the way no university is today. Perkins was weakest in chemistry, so they made her major in chemistry. And they said, if you can beat your weakest subject, you can beat whatever life throws at you. And then they somehow instilled the young women in this sense of heroic aspiration. The slogan of the school was, "Go where no one wants to go, do what no one wants to do." So they took young women, 1902, and they propelled them off to Tibet, to Pakistan, to Africa, to China, doing service and missionary work. Somebody did a census of the American female missionaries abroad in about 1920. 25% of them were Holyoke grads. It's just a heroic sense of service. Perkins went to Chicago. She worked at Hull House for a little while, a settlement house, went to Philadelphia, and then went to New York. In 1913, she's sort of drifting around, vaguely doing good work, but not committed. 1913, she's having tea in Washington Square Park in Lower Manhattan. She and the lady she's having tea with hear a commotion. They rush in the square and they see a fire. She stumbled across one of the most famous fires in American history, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. She sees what she thinks are bundles of clothing being hurled out of the 10th story window. But in fact, it's like 9/11. People are deciding to leap to their deaths rather than being burned to death. And she sees 53 people go over the edge. And she sees a young man holding women across the windowsill and then dropping them into space. A second, a third, the fourth is his girlfriend who he kisses and then drops, and then he himself goes. And this moment has a transformative effect on her. She was already doing good works and of that sort, but this is what you might call the call within the call, the moment when a career becomes a vocation, when the self is quieted and she simply wants to be an instrument to the cause, and she strips away interest in her salary, her security. It's not about self, it's about serving a cause. And she spends the rest of her life focused with what Nietzsche called a long obedience in the same direction, serving this cause, giving her integrity and wholeness and constancy in life. She goes up to Albany to lobby the New York State legislators, and but she finds they won't take her seriously because she's a young woman in the 1920s. But she, at home, she keeps a folder called Notes on the Male Mind. And she says, they won't take me seriously as a young woman, but all men want to be loved by their mothers. And so she begins dressing like an 80-year-old woman. She wears a gray dresses, pearls, tri-corner hat, old-fashioned hairstyle, gets the nickname Mama Perkins, and then passes some amazing legislation, becomes very effective, is hired by Al Smith, is hired by Franklin Roosevelt, and then is hired by Roosevelt as Secretary of Labor, and has a really heroic career, is really one of the founders of the New Deal, creating Social Security as much as anybody else. The little historic coda at the end of her life is that she goes to Cornell. She needs work. She's 83. She needs work. She needs money. And so she teaches at Cornell, but she's living alone, and she's lonely. And she's a frat house knows that she's lonely, and they say, you want to come live in the frat house with us? So she says, yeah. And she writes it to a letter that she's as happy as a bride on her wedding night to be going living in this frat house. And she's 83, and she would sit, the frat boys were playing their music, and she would just sit in the parlor drinking bourbon at night. And she's in one of the better apartments upstairs, and the faculty advisor has the next apartment over, a man named Alan Bloom, who would go on to write The Closing of the American Mind. And then the president of the frat house, who serves as a pallbearer at her funeral, is a man named Paul Wolfowitz, who would go on to be Undersecretary of Defense under President Bush. Little historical paradox there. But she teaches us about vocation. The fourth person I'll mention is the great novelist George Eliot. She was born at the start of the Victorian era. Her mother was ill and nearly died, and did die early in her life, but was unable to give Eliot love. And she grew up emotionally needy as a result. And she needed to be the center of attention. She would fall for every guy she met, tall, short, young, old, married, unmarried. The typical pattern in her 20s, she'd fall for a guy. She'd sort of entrance him with her conversation. The guy would get interested. His wife would throw her out of the house. At 32, she fell for a philosopher named Herbert Spencer, who was her intellectual equal. And she wrote him a letter that was at once pathetic but also impressive. The pathetic part was she begged him to marry her. Please, please marry me. If you marry me, I won't cause you any trouble. You'll barely notice me around the house. If you don't marry me, I'll die. And that was sort of sad, but that was her way. But then in the last paragraph, there's a flourish, which is like a little pivot point in her life. She writes, I suppose no woman ever before wrote such a letter as this, but I am not ashamed, for I am conscious in the light of reason and true refinement that I am worthy of your respect and tenderness, whatever gross men or vulgar-minded women might think of me. And there's a moment in everybody's life, I think usually in their 30s, when they stop relying on the affirmation and criticism from people outside themselves, and they develop an internal criteria to measure themselves and their behavior. We might call an agency moment. It doesn't work out with Spencer, but she meets a guy named George Lewes. Lewes is also a writer who was legally married, but his marriage had become estranged. The woman had gone off and was living with another guy with whom she'd have three children. But nonetheless, Lewes is legally married, and this is Victorian England. If she lives with Lewes, she will be labeled an adulteress, and she will be written out of polite society. She will lose all her friends. Her family will cut her off. And she is a week to decide, Lewes or everybody else. And she doesn't really consult many people. She thinks about it and says, I'm going with Lewes. She writes, I have counted the cost of the step that I have taken and am prepared to bear without irritation or bitterness renunciation by all my friends. I am not mistaken in the person to whom I have attached myself. He is worthy of the sacrifice I have incurred, and my only anxiety is that he should be rightly judged. So she takes this daring leap. And Eliot is a person who is emotionally needy, but is transformed and solidified and deepened by love. What love does, first thing it does is humbles you, because when you're in love, you're not in control of your own mind. It's like being invaded by a conquering army you want to be conquered by. The second thing love does is it plows open hard ground and reveals vulnerability below, so you're capable of greater joys but also greater pain. The third thing it does is it decenters the self, because you realize your riches are not in yourself, they're in another. The fourth thing it does, it creates the sort of fusion of two souls that eliminates the distinction between giving and receiving. Montaigne has a great essay about friendship where he says that the friend who receives the gift from his friend is doing the greater favor, giving the friend the pleasure of giving it. And this is the poetic, passionate kind of love that Taylor Swift sings about. And Elliot experienced that with Luz. But even by the time this has started, she's in her mid-30s, and she's in what the philosopher Roger Scruton calls a second love. And this is a love that comes later in life. It's not as idealistic, it's not as sentimental. It's aware of costs and benefits. It's based on a mature decision about the imperfections in your own life and the imperfections in the other person's life. And it's the kind of love that can happen often after marriage or an older, that is more settled, more realistic, and more vulnerable in a way, and stable. This kind of love was captured by a friend of mine named Leon Wieseltier in a wedding toast that he gave to about 8 years ago. Wieseltier wrote, "This love is private and it is particular. Its object is the specificity of this man and that woman, the distinctiveness of this spirit and that flesh. This love prefers deep to wide and here to there, the grasp to the reach. When the day is done and the lights are out, there's only this other heart, this other mind, this other face to assist in repelling one's demons or in greeting one's angels. It does not matter who the president is. When one consents to marry, one consents to be truly known, which is an ominous prospect. And so one bets on love to correct for the ordinariness of the impression and to call forth the forgiveness that will be required. Marriages are exposures. We may be heroes to our spouses, but we may not be idols." So Elliot had this kind of love, and she chose well. She went off to Germany with Luz. Back in London, all hell broke loose. She was slandered. Everybody cut her off, her family, her brother. But in that semi-isolation, they prospered together. Luz told her, maybe you should try your hand writing fiction, something she hadn't done before. And she came back in a week later with a short story she had written, and she reads it aloud to him, and he starts crying because he understands immediately the talent that she has. And from thence on, in some ways, his love is more superior. He puts his own career in the background and becomes her agent, her editor, her consultant, her publicist, and serves her superior talent. She's very sensitive to criticism, so he gets up early every morning, reads through the newspapers, and if he finds any articles that she's mentioned in, he cuts them out so she won't have to see them. Their devotion is measured in the inscriptions of the novels she wrote. Each time she writes a novel, she hands him a copy with an inscription. Adam Bede in 1859, "To my dear husband George Henry Luce, I give the manuscript of a work which would never have been written but for the happiness which his love has conferred upon my life." Felix Holt in 1866, "From George Eliot to her dear husband, this 13th year of their united life, in which the deepening sense of her own imperfectness has the consolation of their deepening love." Middlemarch in 1872, "To my dear husband George Henry Luce, in this 19th year of our blessed union." And he eventually died, but they had a happy relationship for about 2 decades. And so in her we see someone who is rendered solid and secure and empathetic through a great commitment to a love outside herself. And so when you step back at these people, you see different activities that lead to depth. But I think you come to a different overall worldview than we have, or at least is prevalent today in our culture, sort of a counterculture. We live in a culture where we glorify the self and we glorify our own goodness. But whether it was Eisenhower or Ida Eisenhower or George Eliot or Samuel Johnson, they were acutely aware of their own weakness. And if you look at their philosophy, it adds up to what Immanuel Kant called the crooked timber view of humanity. From the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing is made, he wrote. It has a couple of propositions. The first is we don't live for happiness. We like happiness, pleasure, good mood. But we're endowed by a moral imagination, a spiritual urge to make ourselves better than we used to be. We want to lead a meaningful life. And people are willing to struggle and endure pain for a sense of meaning, which is superior to happiness. Second, we're divided creatures, both deeply broken and splendidly endowed. The struggle against our own weakness is the central drama of life, not the external climb of success. It was more important to all these people that they have a good inner worth than they succeed outwardly, though they all did succeed outwardly too. In this struggle, humility is the greatest virtue. Humility is radical self-honesty. In this struggle, pride is the greatest vice. Pride is blindness to your own self. Character is built over the course of your confrontation with yourself. No person can achieve self-mastery on his or her own. This process of character building they went through involves some introspection, involves an individual process of looking within themselves and figuring out what's wrong. But then it involved an outward process and a communal process, of a commitment process. None of us is strong enough to defeat our own self-deceptiveness, our own selfishness, our own self-centeredness. We need redemptive assistance from outside. And so character is not like a little iron figure inside. Character is the ability to make strong commitments to things outside. In the realm of the intellect, the person of character has firm convictions about fundamental truths. In the realm of emotion, she's embedded in webs of unconditional love. In the realm of action, she is committed to causes that can't be completed in a single lifetime. And that's the big mentality shift that these people invite us to. The second is just more practical. Certain activities that are parts of the day, a vocation, a second love, sitting at night and saying, identifying your core sin, what's my core weakness? How does it lead to behavior that I'm not proud of? I have a friend whose weakness is hardness of heart. He's busy. People come to him, and instead of being present for them, he's thinking about what he has to do 5 minutes from now. Or at a meeting, instead of really listening to the other people at the meeting, he's thinking, what can I say that will make me appear smart? And so at night, he's lying in bed. He thinks, did I do this today? How can I do a little better tomorrow? Second activity that a lot of people do of this sort is they are super conscious of their exemplars. I was at Monticello a few weekends ago, and Thomas Jefferson put all over the home portraits of people he admired, sort of a gallery of the dead that he admired and wanted to live up to, who inspired him. Some of them were scientists, philosophers, statesmen. Even his archenemy, Alexander Hamilton, has a bust on the wall. And he was in conversation with them, setting a standard. A lot of these people, like Johnson, had conversations about moral life. They stepped outside the rush of career and events and had conversations about what does suffering mean, what does honor mean, what does courage mean. And reading and writing a book doesn't make you a good person, I can assure you that. But it does provide a roadmap. And some of this is tough, what they do, but most of it is not. Most of what they did was done with others, relying on others, leaning on others, stumbling with others. And at the end of a lot of these lives, there are moments of just amazing joy. The final person I'll mention is Augustine, St. Augustine, who was born in the 4th century in Africa. And Augustine had a mom named Monica, who was the helicopter mom to beat all helicopter moms. And she was like, had this devouring love for him, telling him what to think, how to act, who to marry, who not to marry. He finally tries to escape her and leaves Africa to go to Italy. She's screaming at him on the beach as he's sailing away. She gets on the next boat, she finds him, she tracks him down. And they fought for much of their lives. Finally, she's in her late 50s, And she says to him, all my life I wanted you to be a certain sort of man and a certain sort of Catholic. And you've become that. This is after his famous conversion or confession. And I'm happy now. And my work here is done. And I'm ready to die. I thought I wanted to die back in Africa, but God is everywhere. It doesn't really matter where I'm buried. And in fact, 9 days later, she does die. But Augustine describes their final conversation, which takes place in a garden. And he, after all the conflict, he describes the sweetness of them coming together. He writes that they did by degrees pass through all things bodily, even the very heaven and the sun and the moon. We came to our own minds and went beyond them into the realm of the pure spirit. It's a very beautiful conversation. He has a long sentence describing it, which is very hard to understand. But he's got one word going throughout it, and that word is hushed. And so he says, the sound of the trees was hushed, the sound of the birds was hushed, the sound of our voices was hushed, the sound of our hearts and breathing was hushed, and you get this sense of tranquility and silence. And the ambitions of Adam 1 are never satisfied. There's always something else out there. But you do see in these people moments when their spiritual natures are just quiet and subsumed in gratitude. And from the gratitude glows the inner light you see in them. So thanks very much.
And we have some time for questions. So there's a mic on this side and the other. So step on up if you have a question.
Sir.
Thank you for coming to Seattle. And it's been interesting to watch you the last few years, even though you're still with the New York Times and NewsHour and Meet the Press. It appears you've been going through a career change, and it's inspiring to see that. And it's inspiring to hear about these examples of people who are on the search that maybe a lot of us in this room are. But can you give us some examples of people that you see and know today in public life who will illustrate some of the principles you just talked about?
Sure. Thank you for that question. So I keep a list of people, always five people I admire in Washington, just so I can feel, well, there are at least five good people here. And there are people like Elliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner. No, I'm kidding. There are some of them you would know, some of them you wouldn't know, but some of the people who are perpetually on my list, he's elderly now, but he's been a hero to me, a guy named George Shultz, who was secretary of various things in various administrations. The job was never about him. It was always about service to the country. A friend of mine who now works in the Obama administration is named Samantha Power and has a deep, passionate goodness and also a practicalness that shows up in her public life and has shown up in private service she's done to me in hard times. A man I barely know, but who I admire from afar and I think is an exemplar of humility, is a doctor and a writer named Atul Gawande, whose work is about how little we know and how modest we should be. And then for many years, I worked for two men, with two men who were remarkable. I mentioned Shields. He's really just a tremendously sweet man. And then I worked for a guy named Jim Lehrer. In the first 10 years of doing the show, you can't really see when I'm talking on the screen. When he's on the screen, his face is relatively stoic. But when I'm talking, it's expressive. And if I said something that was egotistical or cheap, I could see his mouth sort of curl down. And if I said something he liked, his eyes would glow a little. And so I spent 10 years trying to avoid the turndowns and get the glow. And that was the way mentors teach, just with a little gesture. And I would include him in that.
Mr. Brooks, I've been yelling at your TV image and your radio voice for years, so thank you for it.
Join the club.
A very simple question. What do you think is the ethical response to the Baltimore riots, and do you think our political class equipped to effect such a response?
Well, there are two obvious responses. It seems to me there are two things here. The first is the police brutality issue. And, you know, I was a police reporter for a little while, and I know the stress they're under. And I know how scared they feel. We think they're coming with the guns, and they must feel like they're king of the world. They're in foreign territory. They never know what's going to happen. They're stressed. That having said, there are a certain number of officers, a minority, who for whom their petty authority is their ego drug, for whom they need to impose will and authority on others. And probably a lot of us have seen that, but if remember, as minority groups, we've seen it times cubed. And so they need that. There needs to be an education about that, training about that. There also needs to be training about just basic race relations in this country. If you ask white cops around the country, do African Americans and whites get treated equally? Something like 90% say yes, it's treated equally. Well, that's probably not true. And so there needs to be a special bending over backwards to correct that. The second issue is just the nature of poverty. And this is the lifelong challenge for us. And we've frankly spent a fair bit of money on poverty. We spend on average, I think it's $13,000 per person in poverty, just on the federal level, not including education dollars. If we handed out the money, we'd cure poverty. But that's because the intricacies of poverty are just more complex. They have to do with loss of jobs, psychological stress caused by disorganized neighborhoods, family breakdown. There's a complex stew. And the only thing that I think works, since we don't really understand the complexity of the stew, is creating countercultural zones where you throw everything you can at the problem all at once. In New York, we have a thing called the Harlem Children's Zone, where they just throw everything at the problem. And you don't know what's going to work. You don't know what's going to prevent a 16-year-old girl from getting pregnant or a guy from joining a gang. But you just throw it all out there and you try to create a counterculture. And somehow I think we have to spread that model around.
But do you consider like initiatives like those proposed by Paul Ryan, for example, to combat poverty, are those really sufficient? Is there?
I don't want to have it get back and forth just so we can finish up. But so Paul Ryan wants to decentralize welfare programs around the states. And I see some virtue in having state laboratories, but I think his would also involve cutting back overall spending, which I wouldn't support. Sir.
I heard you mention education as maybe an outgrowth or a part of the problem when you first started speaking. And I've noticed in my lifetime that our undergraduate institutions seem to have migrated more towards putting a lot of emphasis on creating an environment that makes students feel like they're going to be or are part of the privileged class. Do you agree with that? And how do you think our undergraduate institutions should change, if you do?
Yeah. Well, I do know I teach an institution where 63% of the grades are A's. And the number of A's that have in high American high schools has increased, probably doubled in a generation. We're rewarding a lot while requiring less work. I actually think the main problem is not, some of it is, as I say, is the ego feeding, is the, you know, just you love yourself, love yourself, love yourself, which is a descendant, a bastardized descendant from the humanistic psychology of Carl Rogers. But the second problem is just the obsession with college, getting into the right college and getting the right career, and the way that becomes a measure of worth. And that does crowd out every other consideration. There was a study done at Harvard, Harvard School of Education, that I just saw after I finished the book. They asked junior high school students, what do your parents, the 10,000 of them, what do your parents care more about, whether you get good grades or whether you're kind? And 80% of the students said they care about my grades more than whether I'm kind. And I'm sure if some of those of us who are parents, we probably do nag more about that stuff. But that is sending the wrong message. And I wrote a column about something that I care a lot about. I'll just do 1 minute on it. I teach at an Ivy League institution. About 15 or 20% of my kids, their parents love them and they want to hone them. And when the kids do what the parents think will lead to success, the beam of love shines strong. When the kids get off the track that their parents approve of, the beam of love is withdrawn. And so they think they're only worthy of love if they're performing it a certain way. The most important relationship in their life is insecure, and they're terrified of losing that love. And conditional love is like an epidemic. And that's another thing I've become passionate about.
You wrote recently an article about conquering fear. And as I understand your fear is that if we come to an agreement on Iran, you have some fears about that. So what could we do to alleviate those fears?
So I see this as a policy matter, not as a psychological matter, but I could be wrong. Just quickly on Iran, my belief is it's on the nature of the regime. And the way I put it in an article is, are they Lenin or are they Gorbachev? Do they believe in their regime as a revolutionary regime and a radical ideology? Or have they lost faith in their revolution, and do they want to rejoin the community of nations? If they've lost faith and they're ready to rejoin the community of nations, then this is a great deal for the president's doing. He'll deserve the Nobel Peace Prize because they will use the deal as a way back to the community, and they'll be a wonderful partner in the world. But as I read the speeches by Khomeini and others, they still are a revolutionary state, and they'll use the money to continue to fund Hezbollah and terrorist organizations, and they will become, as many people have said, continuation of the problem in the region, not the solution. So it's a bet on what they believe. And as I read Khomeini, I think the people who run the regime, not the people of Iran, but the people who run the regime, are still revolutionary and radical and dangerous.
Yeah. Getting back to your book, I'm interested in your metaphor of Adam 1 and Adam 2. I grew up, actually older than you, with the holding only the values that you mentioned. But you still have to reconcile those two. Man has to eat before he can have philosophy. and it's unfair to characterize you either this or you're that. It's more important, I think, how you be a moral police officer in Baltimore.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. If I didn't make that clear, I was my mistake. I think what Soloveitchik is arguing is you need both, and they need to be in balance. And that he's not denigrating the worldly success. And the people in my book were very successful in worldly terms. Eisenhower was president. George Marshall was Secretary of State. But he did think that sometimes the value systems are in contrast. And he would have said, you have to bring, as you said, you have to bring your values into the work. And you can't live bifurcated lives. And I think I didn't stress that properly. And so I'm grateful for the correction. That if you're a police officer, the values of courage, honor, have to be brought into the work. And one of the questions I was debating in my last column was whether you could be a bad person and a good at a career. Can you be an unpleasant, dishonest person and a good leader? And I fundamentally don't think you can. Excuse me?
You could be very moral and quite a failure in your professional life.
That's true. But I don't think you could be immoral and a worldly success, maybe in hedge funds. But that's unfair. All the hedge fund managers out there, I apologize. I'm sorry. But most professions are about relationships. And you can't have good relationships here if you're dishonest and transactional. So I do think the two have to be worked together. You're right, and that's a good correction.
Two-part question, please. What's your reaction to basically the F-bomb that generally isn't being addressed in the Times as far as the rise of American fascism when it's dressed up as American exceptionalism, and also the beatification of Pius XII, which is about to be slipped by? and the fact that Vatican responsibility under Pius XI and Pius XII appears to be a holy cow that nobody wants to go near.
Well, I really have no opinion on Pius XII. I'm not Catholic. I just don't know enough to have an opinion. I will say something about the current pope. I read that nice Dave Jolly thing on the message is the person. So I'm not knowledgeable about Catholic theology, particularly at least post-Augustine, which was a long time ago. But when he wrote the message is the person, the way Pope Francis handles himself seems to be an exemplification of that. He handles himself well, and the message is the person. That's what, to me, Christians should look like and act like. As for American fascism, I guess I disagree. I don't think there is a rise of American fascism. There's a Tea Party movement that I'm not a huge fan of. There are Republicans. I wouldn't say they're fascists. Fascists believe in using government in a totalistic way. I think that's one problem I see very little of.
Okay. Thank you.
Two more.
Hi, thank you for coming tonight, and thank you so much for your work. I'll just read my question to keep it brief. You draw really deftly and graciously from both secular and religious sources in your work, and in our culture, these broad categories often clash. I'm wondering if you can speak to the productive tension between them in your work.
Yeah, thank you. So I observe that there are wonderful people who are secular, and there are wonderful people who are religious. And in the book, some of the people, George Eliot was not a believer. Dorothy Day was an intense believer. And, you know, I just observed that you can be both. The one thing I do think it's useful to have, whether you're secular or faithful, is a vocabulary of moral growth. And it is just a fact of our civilization that most of that vocabulary emerged religiously. And there are words like sin, soul, grace, redemption, virtue. And the big one for me is the word sin. Now, sin is a word that's dropped out of our culture in any meaningful way. We now use it in the context of fattening desserts. But but it was once an important word, and I think it's worth bringing back. And it dropped out of our culture because people used the word sin to be harshly judgmental, to punish pleasure, to punish sex. But I think it's worth modernizing and reviving, because unlike a word like weakness, sin reminds us that life is a moral drama and that there's moral stakes involved in everyday decisions and how we construct our souls. The other thing I like about sin is it's collective. A weakness is individual, but sins are things we all share and we all have in common: self-centeredness, shallowness. I think it's a word. These words are worth bringing back. And if you don't have the words, it's really hard to talk about what's going on inside. And then the final thing I'll say is you can be religious or not, but if you read religious writers, uplifting religious writers like C.S. Lewis or Augustine or Dorothy Day, you learn a lot about human nature. And you may discover faith, you may not, but you'll be around extremely wise people. I teach my book, I taught it as a course at Yale. And I have 14 readings ranging from Montaigne to Samuel Johnson to books about Eisenhower, all the people I've mentioned. One of the books is a book by Dorothy Day called The Long Loneliness. And at the end of the term, I ask the students, pick one of the readings, any one, and apply it to a personal problem you're dealing with. That's the final paper. And in the last term, out of my 24 students, 18 or 19 of them chose Dorothy Day. And it wasn't because they were faithful, believe me, the most are not. But there's an emotional intensity and a moral rigor to her and a community service that they find entrancing. And so, faithful or not, people who are going through great spiritual growth are exciting people. And some people like her or Lewis, they're going through that. Final question.
I wonder if it's almost tied to what she was hitting on, but you shared some really compelling statistics about growing narcissism, and I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit more deeply of what is at the root of that? Like, what has changed that is so profoundly becoming such a problem?
Thank you. And I will take this as the final. We should end. We're a little over time. So a couple things have changed. One, the meritocracy is more competitive, so you just got to broadcast yourself more. And I see this in my students. They're awesome at sucking up and dropping a little humble brags about what they've done with their lives. Second, social media and reality TV. But to me, one of the things I discovered in researching the book was the cultural shift from a culture that said, of self-effacement, that said, you're nobody better than anybody else, but nobody's better than you, to a culture of distinction that said, you're pretty special. And I thought the conventional storyline, especially on the right, is that it happened in the 60s. There was this noble group called the Greatest Generation, and then came those narcissistic baby boomers. But I found that's not historically accurate. The big shift happened between 1946 and 52. Basically, Americans had been through the Depression and the war, a bunch of years of renunciation and sacrifice. The war ends, they just want to loosen up. And so what happens is there's this huge shoot up in consumption and advertising. Get your desire, trust your desire, get what you want, grab, 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 the Mad Men era. And then along comes a series of books that take a look at the Holocaust, take a look at the war, and they say, let's just close off that view of human nature, all that darkness. So there's a book by a guy named Joshua Liebman that comes out right after World War II that says, we're going to write a new Ten Commandments. It's not going to be thou shalt not, all that negative stuff. It will be thou shalt love thyself, thou shalt honor thyself, thou shalt obey thyself. And that book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 56 straight weeks. Then another book called The Mature Mind comes out saying the same thing. That's number one for 26 weeks. Then The Power of Positive Thinking gets out, which is on number one for 98 straight weeks, still the record. And then Carl Rogers in Humanistic Psychology says human beings are inherently good. They just need to actualize themselves. Then Dr. Spock comes out with his baby book that says, which is a subtle book in many ways and a very good book in some ways, but it's a very upbeat view of human nature. He says, if your child steals something, just give him what he's stolen and tell him he can get whatever he wants if he asks. I think that's an optimistic view of human nature. And so that comes out. And so you get this whole range of a shift in culture. And so I think we need to rebalance a little. I wouldn't want to go back to the 40s. It was a sexist culture, a racist culture, really boring food. But that little sense of self, I think, is something we can learn from and modernize and rediscover. So thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. David Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times and commentator for PBS, NPR, and NBC. He teaches at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on April 29, 2015. This talk was presented by the Elliott Bay Book Company. Thanks again to Kevin Mitchum for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.